Do you find yourself wondering about whether you should explore weight loss injections, or are you struggling to decide whether or not HRT might be for you? I'm asked all the time about HRT particularly, and is it something that's going to help me to lose weight? Is it something that's going to help me to maintain weight loss? And it's a really tricky thing to figure out on your own. And that's why I've got the wonderful Dr. Sherry Price on the podcast. She is a pharmacist, certified life and weight loss coach, and host of the Health Habits and Epic Living podcast. Dr. Price's work is dedicated to helping women to take charge of their health and wellness through lifestyle, mindset, and habit change. And in today's episode, we're going to be getting into HRT, weight loss injections, making changes that last, and addressing some of the self-soothing behaviors that we might do to get through frustrating or difficult times, like using alcohol or comfort eating, and how we can start to move away from those behaviors in place of much healthier ways of managing those feelings. Welcome to The Thriving Metabolism. I'm your host, Louise Digby. I'm a registered nutritional therapist and women's weight loss expert. I'm founder of The Nourish Method to Lasting Fat Loss. And it's my mission to empower you so that you and your metabolism thrives. Let's dive in. Welcome back. And I have got Sherry Price here with me, and I'm really excited to dig in and find out all about what she does and how she does it. So welcome, Sherry. Really pleased to have you here.
Oh, thank you. This is awesome. Thanks for the opportunity to join your podcast.
So I'm really intrigued about your career progression, because you started off as a pharmacist and then you've moved more into becoming sort of coaching and mindset focused. So tell me about kind of your story and kind of how you've ended up where you are.
Yeah, I practiced as a pharmacist for 20 plus years, loved it, still do. Just fascinates me to see how drugs, when they enter the body, all their physiologic effects, how they change our biology, how they bind to receptors and all the mechanisms that they do. They definitely have a place in therapy. However, over time, I wanted to really get into a deeper relationship with people, because I know sometimes throwing drugs or medications at a problem doesn't necessarily fix the underlying root of the problem. It may help with some symptoms and help diminish some of the symptoms people are experiencing, but really getting to the root. So diabetes is a classic example. Great medications out there for helping people with diabetes, but if the person is not educated on really how they change their lifestyle, how they need to change their eating and the way they think about food, I feel that those medications are more like a band-aid, and they do help. But what would really help the patient is really understanding lifestyle and making those changes. So I really love helping people identify lifestyle changes, and that takes a bit of time. And that's a separate discussion away from medications a lot of times, and really help people win at life, win at their health. So you can do medications. Yes, I'm all for it. However, it's just a small percentage of the overall health picture. And so I transitioned into coaching because I found that that was where my passion was. After being as a pharmacist for 20 plus years, I really wanted to work with individuals more personally and really make a bigger impact on their overall health.
Yeah, I can totally understand that. I used to work in a pharmacy many years ago, not as a pharmacist, but just as like an assistant. You know, it's frustrating for me to see so many people on all these medications that just aren't really addressing the problem properly. And it seems like every time you see them, they're on another medication. And yeah, it's really heartbreaking to see. And it's really refreshing to hear that, you know, you are looking further than just a pill for an ill and actually getting to the root cause and working on behavior change and all those things, because I think so many people are so frustrated with going to the doctors and just either being told that it's just their age or it's just menopause, or just being given a pill that isn't really aligned with what they're trying to achieve. So yeah, great to hear that you've made that shift. Now, I also know that you've got a podcast, which is Health Habits and Epic Living, which I love the name. What inspired you to start your podcast?
Oh, so when I first started my podcast, it was called Drink Less Lifestyle. And I was really helping women coming out of COVID reduce their drinking habit. So a lot of women fell into, you know, the kids are back at home, husband may or may not be working or back at home, or I'm not working, or I have to, you know, stay at home to educate the kids. And so things got very wonky during that time, as I like to say. So a lot of people turned to alcohol to cope. I had that as my history as well. Didn't feel like an addict, but felt like this was just a nightly habit that I became used to doing to take the edge off, to deal with stress, to deal with the transition from work life to home life. Like, it just became this ritual that I did that became like part of my lifestyle. And I knew it wasn't helping me. So when I first started my podcast, it was really to help other women not wait until things get really bad around alcohol, but really just to develop some awareness of this gray area drinking and help them identify, hey, is this feeling like where I'm heading? And if I want to course correct or change that habit, practical ways to do that. So I started off basically really just focusing on alcohol. And a lot of that could be translated to other ways you might self-soothe or through food. Some people do it through other mechanisms like overworking. And just really highlighting how the brain gets stuck in these ruts and really what's going to help them get out. And then I decided to, like, that was feeling wonderful for the 2 years that I've done it. And then I just wanted to expand, because I'm sure across the globe this is happening, but particularly here in the US, right? We have like just an epidemic of diabetes and metabolically unhealthy. And then we could get into this potentially as well, as I'm transitioning into menopause, feeling that the healthcare system is not set up for me to get to the root cause of, or being a champion of certain modalities to help me stay young, healthy, vibrant, and alive, be given the publications out there around hormone replacement therapy. And so I just really wanted to widen the conversation for women. It's like, okay, health is one aspect that we want to look at to make sure that we are, you know, not overusing it, not using it, you know, as this way to cope with life, but really expanding that conversation to other parts of our health and drilling down to those root causes of what's causing the menopause symptoms and how really to manage that, more lifestyle and also some medication as well.
So it's a really interesting progression of your podcast. And I'd love to touch a little bit more on the alcohol side of things, because it's not something that I've spoken much about on this podcast. So, you know, with the people that you work with or have worked with in regards to alcohol, do you find that alcohol can be a healthy part of a lifestyle, or is it something that really needs to be avoided at all costs?
So my philosophy is not to avoid at all costs, because for me, I wasn't ready to go there. And so if I joined a program that I felt that was the end goal for everybody, I also would feel shame if I wasn't aligned with that goal. And I already had so much shame about having a nightly Chardonnay habit. So I didn't want to put myself in an environment where I was not being true to what I wanted. And I'd feel bad, and like I'd have to be like playing a side of me that really didn't want to quit altogether. Do I feel that alcohol benefits the body at all? Not really. However, I want to meet people where they're at. And if I was willing to decrease my drinking by 50 to 80%, and I felt if I just did that and I can help others do that, that is major on your health, right? So I don't believe in the all or nothing philosophy for everybody, right? I think it's where you're at. Let's go with what you're willing to do. Let's make those shifts. Let's teach you some habits to self-soothe that don't require food, that don't require alcohol, because I want you to see how life feels with that. And if that feels great in your body, maybe then you'll say, okay, I'm done with alcohol, or maybe not. But I know there's such a way to connect with people. People meet up for happy hours. People meet at the pub. It brings this level of connection that people are really afraid to sometimes say, oh, I'm sober, or put themselves in a category. And that might be too jarring or too fear-inducing for somebody at first. So we just take it little by little, because cutting back even just a couple of drinks a week really benefits your liver, your brain. It really starts to reduce your risk of the 13 cancers that could come from over imbibing in alcohol. So I think any type of reduction, and that's considered harm reduction. So I believe more in a harm reduction philosophy than an all or nothing philosophy.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it's the same for so many things, you know, whether it's trying to eat more vegetables or work out a little bit more, you know, doing something, some type of improvement in that area is going to be more maintainable and is going to be more achievable to sustain in the long term. So you're going to get more benefit than trying to just go the whole hog and cut out alcohol completely or whatever it might be. So yeah, completely on board with that.
And don't you find women will like want to do it perfectly? I deal with a lot of perfectionistic mentality, right? We want to do it perfectly. No alcohol, none, not a drop. And then if they fail, the shame gets even worse and it keeps them in this cycle of like, well, why even try? Because I can't seem to really help myself. And so I love getting help and encouraging people to get help, because sometimes it is a little challenging to do it on your own, especially if you don't have the other tools.
Yeah, I definitely see so much perfectionism, and it's something that can really stop people from even getting started, because they're like looking at their schedule and they're thinking, oh no, not this week because I've got such and such going on, or I can't start until a few months' time because then my diary is clear. But actually, the way that we achieve true transformation is by making small changes whilst we've still got all these other things going on, because then we learn how to do these things when life isn't perfect, and life is never perfect. So it's about just getting started and doing something rather than waiting for that perfectly clear few weeks in the diary for you to be able to get started properly.
I wholeheartedly agree on that.
Great. So you talked a little bit about self-soothing behaviors, and obviously alcohol is one of those things, and it presents in different people in different ways. What are some of the ways that people can start addressing some of these self-soothing behaviors that perhaps hold them back from moving forward towards their health goals?
When we self-soothe, right, it's really trying to damper down something we are experiencing within the body or even the mind. A lot of overachievers will think it's all in my mind, but sometimes it is manifesting in the body. It could be anxiety. It could be a feeling of stress. It could be a feeling of overwhelm. It could be like, gosh, I have worked all day and now I have to take care of the kiddos. And so your body is like wanting reprieve from that. It wants to soothe away some of those emotional feelings. So I think getting in touch with your emotions and, you know, starting with just simple things like naming it, like this is what I'm feeling, this is what I'm experiencing, that starts to separate what's going on in the person versus the action. Because I think a lot of us will just focus on the action. Oh, I shouldn't drink. Oh, I shouldn't want alcohol. And so focusing on the behavior or the action makes us like identify if something is good or bad just by if we take the action or not. And I rather get ahead of it to say, okay, what's going on in the mind? What's going on in the body? What are you feeling? Name that. And then we can look at other modalities to help soothe if the body needs that, right? That reaction that we're having to the perceived environment, right? So the stress of cooking a meal, getting the kids' homework done, getting them bathed, getting them into the bed, because that's when it happened for me. It was when my daughter was young and I'm like, oh, this will just make the night go easier. There'll be less fighting, or I won't be so upset because there's all this battling of getting them in the tub. And then when you're in the tub, they don't want to come out of the tub and then they don't want to go into bed. And so it just felt like, ah, if you would just play the roles on my terms, things would go so much easier. But they're little humans, right? So they have their own desires and their own wishes and their own emotions. And so learning how to like coexist and then be able to not have that aggravate you or frustrate you, I think is the way we should be like leaning towards, because otherwise we're always going to be saying, okay, more alcohol, because now this frustration came up. Now I'm stressed about this. And so it just kept me kind of chained to the fridge of like pouring another drink. And so really focusing on those emotions that are starting to arise and finding ways to soothe those rather than using something outside of us like alcohol or food.
So if I'm understanding properly, it sounds like you're saying that we need to start off by understanding what we're feeling better and kind of identifying and naming those emotions. And then that's going to help us to start soothing in other ways other than trying to suppress those feelings with alcohol or whatever that not so healthy habit might be. Is that right?
Similar, yes. And just to phrase in another way, if you look at the famous TED talk about what cures addiction is connection. And that's the bottom line from this famous TED talk that went viral. And if you think about it, any behavior that you're doing to self-soothe, like if you're not truly physiologically hungry and you're just emotionally eating or just emotionally drinking, right, which basically alcohol is, you are wanting to disconnect from what you are feeling. Wanting to connect with yourself is something that's was foreign to me. You know, I had this habit of nightly drinking for 8+ years, and it was foreign to want to connect with those emotions because I always disconnected by pouring a glass of wine. So I think connection, some people think connection with others, that could be part, but I also think connection back to yourself. And that's where identifying those emotions, identifying what's going on inside of me, identifying maybe where I'm not happy in life. And if I could get to that root cause and change that, you know, that's going to be a long-lasting behavior change where I won't need the alcohol or won't want so much of it.
Absolutely. That's a really helpful clarification. You know, talking about connecting with yourself, you know, I hadn't thought of it like that before. And I think going to help a lot of people to think of it like that. I really want to take advantage of your pharmacist knowledge and ask you a little bit about some of the common medications and questions that my clients typically have, which are around things like HRT and weight loss drugs. So let's start with HRT. A lot of women ask me the question, should I take HRT? Is it going to help me lose weight? And I'd love to know how you would answer this question.
Yes, I think we have a similar philosophy in listening to some of your podcast episodes in that if you take the right hormone replacement therapy, it can be super beneficial to your body. So by the right type, it's the right route of administration, the right formulation, and if it's bioidentical, right, or versus synthetic. So we know that there have been studies out there that looked at maybe it was the wrong formulation, it was synthetic, and we saw that the body doesn't handle things that well because it doesn't mimic what our bodies produce. So if you look at the conjugated equine estrogen, comes from horse's urine, that was in the famous WHI study, which basically shot hormones down for a lot of people and created panic and created so much of a disservice around actual bioidentical hormones, which have different properties than our synthetic ones, which mimic actually the estrogen and the progesterone that we have in our bodies and don't cause all of those scary symptoms that we saw from the WHI. And we have so much data on that. And that's not being discussed because there's so much fear-mongering around hormone replacement therapy. Even in pharmacy school, we were taught about synthetic hormones. We were not taught about bioidentical hormones, even as a pharmacist. So this is something I had to educate myself on outside of the traditional schooling. And I'm hearing that from my physician counterparts. I'm hearing that from my nursing counterparts, people are now coming to me saying, oh my gosh, I don't even know the difference. Like, can you educate me? And sometimes I work here with a pharmacist that does a compounding pharmacy, and he's like, he's educating doctors all the time because they think they're prescribing bioidenticals because there's just so many different chemicals on the market. How do you know which is synthetic, which is bioidentical? And so just getting this education out into the brains of people and so they can make the best decision for themselves. But we know that women, when they go through perimenopause and into menopause, there is a big cliff that they go over with the loss of estrogen, with the loss of progesterone. And it just causes a whole host of symptoms. Gosh, I think over 90 different symptoms I see that you can develop when you're going through that transition. And so just by replenishing them, women feel like they get themselves back. We know estrogen is a body shredder in terms of fat. So there is going to be weight gain and belly fat and visceral fat once you go through the transition. And so there are ways to navigate through that that are healthier and that maybe conventional medicine may not be knowing about all of these benefits.
Absolutely. I see a lot of women who are back and forth to their doctor constantly adjusting their doses, trying adding in progesterone, adding in testosterone, taking it out, trying different creams and all different things. And some of them just seem to have a real battle finding their optimal kind of prescription. Is this normal? Is this what we should expect because of how hormones change as you go through perimenopause? Or is it just that they're not getting the right guidance in the first place?
Yeah. And every practitioner I'm finding has a different way to measure levels. Some will do salivary, some will do blood, some will do spot urine. You also have to take into account like how versed is your practitioner in doing hormones? Is this something they do regularly? Do they stay up on the training? Or is this something they're not really that versed in? And so I think doing your homework first is important. And then second, I think some women go through this transition flawlessly. Very little symptoms. Maybe their estrogen and progesterone are coming down more slowly than some other women who might have erratic changes. To say a blanketed statement, I just don't think it exists. I think each woman is going to be different as they go through these changes. And I think assessing levels is very important because you really want to know how your body is doing on these different formulations. And so I'm a big proponent of the transdermal for estrogen because the oral we know that has more risk associated with it. And so doing the transdermal or the creams would be preferred route. With progesterone, you can do the oral. We don't see the side effects like we do with estrogen. So progesterone can be oral, it can be creams as well. And making sure that those are the bioidentical versions of those. And then just checking and assessing. I know myself, I'm on these agents and I like to just check in periodically to see how my levels are doing, to see if, you know, now I need more as I'm transitioning or just how my body's responding to them. So it's going to be an individual journey on these. But I think having a knowledgeable practitioner really helps reduce a lot of the confusion and a lot of the follow-up visits too.
And I know probably most women here who are having the levels monitored for adjustment of their medication are probably having blood tests done with their doctors. And as far as I understand, that isn't the best way to measure your hormones because it's not necessarily giving you like tissue levels of your hormones. Are those tests still helpful or are they not really giving us enough information to be able to adjust medications?
Yeah, it depends on what hormones you're testing, right? Like cortisol, I don't feel that that's the most accurate. You get one level, right? So salivary is going to be better. Progesterone, you can, different practitioners will say different things around that. If you do a blood level, I think it's very important to make sure it's timed appropriately and knowing what day of your cycle, because you won't be able to interpret the results because as estrogen fluctuates throughout the month. So I think, you know, having that discussion, if you're a practitioner knows, okay, some practitioners will only test on day 19 through 21, for instance, because they know the levels there. My practitioner knows how to interpret the levels no matter when you go. Just having that discussion with her ahead of time, right? I did my homework. She's not educating me on this. I did my homework and said, okay, you know, I'm looking up and learning about the different ways you can monitor them, blood, estrogen, and getting her understanding. I do ask for even clinical trials. Like I do ask for literature, what has been supported, because that's important to me as a pharmacist that we do it evidence-based and we have clinical trials showing, if there are clinical trials, right? Sometimes there aren't, but if there is data showing, hey, this works in this fashion, I really like to read that information for myself. So I think that's important too, is like empower yourself to ask questions, because I think you understand it so much more rather than, oh, I went to this doctor, this happened, and then you don't know how to select your next physician or practitioner, or maybe you get confused because you have a best friend that's saying her doctor does it this way and your doctor does it that way. So I think really empowering yourself with that knowledge is great.
I think that's so important, because even as someone who's a bit more in the know, you know, whenever I've gone to the doctors and the doctors told me something that I don't agree with, it's really difficult to advocate for yourself and say, actually, you know, I don't think that's quite right, or I think that maybe we should do this instead. Yeah, so if you go in armed with the knowledge, then it makes it much easier. And also, I think doctors are finding that this is happening more and more, that their patients are more educated and they're perhaps a little bit more prepared to have a bit of a back and forth about the action plan rather than just being prescriptive.
Exactly. And I don't do it as a way to make them feel bad. You know, I think there's a good bedside manner you can have both ways. Your physician has with you, you have with your physician. I do it in a very respectful way. I went to one appointment where I've actually brought data with me in the trials. And I said, this is what I'm interested in, and here's why. And I was received with great feedback, like, wow, I haven't read this study. Do you mind if I take this? I'd love to educate myself more on this. Because they're so busy and they're seeing all different types of conditions and people and phases of life. And so keeping up, this is something I want to empower them to keep up with the information as well. And so sharing that in a way that I'm advocating for what I want, and then having that open and honest discussion, and also seeing a way that I might be able to educate the practitioner just to other modalities. And sometimes it's a great fit, and sometimes, you know, you can decide it's not a great fit.
Yeah, and I think that's always a really good sign when your physician is receptive to that, to reading new studies and, you know, processing new information, because sometimes they're just not, and that's not a good sign to me, a bit of a red flag. So I would love to move this conversation on to talking a little bit more about weight loss injections, because they are the hot topic and I am being asked about them more and more. And I would love to know your opinion of them and kind of what you've experienced so far with them as well.
So these are the GLP-1 agonists. I imagine that you're speaking of, at least here in the United States, they go by the name of like Wegovy, Mounjaro. Yeah, they are selling like bonkers over here. A lot of people very much interested in them. They do have some great data. I will say they have some of the agents out there really have great data in terms of weight loss, in terms of cardiovascular mortality risk, right? They are starting to really make a mark in that territory. My concern, I have a few concerns. There are some side effects that come with these agents. And from what I've been reading, some of these side effects don't always go away when you stop the medication. Some people have said that they lose the pleasure of eating. And even when they stop these agents, they don't seem to have the same level of pleasure around eating. Some people will get into this downward spiral of like, oh, I wasn't hungry before and now I'm hungry and something is wrong with me. So coming off of these medications, we have to make sure that like they're not shaming themselves if the hunger does come back, because that's natural. I don't mind that these cause weight loss, but also I think the behavior changes to get to the root cause should be done in tandem with the medication. Myself, my philosophy is these patients shouldn't be on these long-term. They should be just helping them, maybe motivate them, maybe drop a couple of pounds, but really look at how they're going to change their lifestyle and their eating patterns and things that are really going to benefit them long-term, because we just don't have that long-term data with these agents. the mechanism by which they work is they really raise GLP-1 to super physiologic doses. So doses that we couldn't get there on our own. However, most people don't know that there are ways you can raise GLP-1 just by behavioral changes and what you feed yourself with. So there are ways to increase GLP-1, have that satiation, not have so many sugar cravings, right? It's probably things you teach, I teach as well, right? So that if they wanted to be free and off of this drug, they can look at ways that they can do those modifications in their own life. So they're not feeling compelled like they have to take this medication to have weight loss benefits, because we know the hormones, right, that go into what causes weight gain, what causes fat storage, and how to reverse that. So I love really educating people around that first. And then if they decide to do a short-term stint of one of these weight loss agents, just to see maybe more dramatic results, but not something that I would be a proponent of long-term.
I find it concerning as well that there isn't that support alongside that medication and all that course of treatment to help them change behaviors and or change what they're eating, because, you know, it's all well and good losing weight, but if you're still putting in food that isn't nourishing you, supporting your hormones or addressing the imbalances in your body, then the changes or the progress is going to be short-lived, because eventually you're going to have to stop that medication. And, you know, when you do, the likelihood is that those habits haven't changed. And so you'll end up back where you were, potentially, like you said, with the side effects still persisting. So that's my concern for it. But I'm sure that there are instances where actually it is the best option. And so, you know, as with anything, you've got to look at the individual and decide what is going to be the best for this person, right?
Absolutely. And my mom is on one right now, and it is the best option given where she's at in her health journey. But I wouldn't recommend it long-term, but yes. So I do see a role for them. You know, and also it's fascinating, like really looking at what type of weight people are losing. Are they losing skeletal muscle weight? Are they losing fat weight? Is it, you know, so I think the type of monitoring is important if you're on these medications, like really understanding what type of weight is coming off the body, because we don't want to make people thin and frail, right? That's not the definition of a healthy life. So really looking at the type of weight. So I hope proper monitoring is going on with the type of weight that's coming off the body.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So as someone who wears many hats and has lots of things going on, you're a pharmacist, you're a coach, you're a podcast host, how do you maintain health and stay balanced with all of that going on?
Yeah, it's not a secret formula. I just want everybody to know, everybody, it's what works for you in your phase of life. So in my phase of life, I am able to get in strength training at least 2 days a week. I've learned through podcasters and through books how important that is as a woman in her 50s to maintain that skeletal muscle mass, to feed my bones the structure it needs. Muscle is a great glucose disposal as well. So it's going to help me lower my risk of diabetes. It's going to help me lower my blood glucose, which will help me lower insulin, which will help me keep off belly fat. So I understand that those two sessions a week probably makes the most difference in anything I can do other than what goes in my mouth, right? That would be second, right? So strength training just has so many benefits. And doing it where you're actually getting progressive overload right to the muscle. So not just going in and going through the motions like I see some people at the gym, but really going in there to develop muscle, because we lose it as we age, and we lose it significantly, unfortunately, particularly as we lose the estrogen, which helps keep it on our frames. So as the estrogen goes down, we're going to lose skeletal muscle mass and be more prone to belly fat coming on. So I know that is priority number one. Then I would say priority number two for me is just evaluating why I'm eating, when I'm eating, what I'm eating, and how I'm eating it. I know that's a lot of questions, but it's very important because I think people just focus on what they're eating. And I think there's value to that, but there's more value if you could say why, when, and how. So this goes into intermittent fasting. This goes into, am I eating just because I'm emotional and I don't know really why I'm eating? I'm just throwing stuff in my mouth, or because everybody else around me is eating, that's why I'm eating. Like, there are just so many reasons why we might be choosing to eat. And I really like to eat when my body is truly hungry. And so I need to know what those cues feel like. I need to come back inside my body and connect with it and not just be out there in the world being persuaded by what other people are doing around me. I also see people being persuaded by the clock. Oh, it's just time to eat. But maybe your body's not hungry for that lunch. Maybe your body is not hungry for that lunch right now. So I think really tuning in and connecting with your body tells you so much about, oh yes, this is true physiologic hunger. And this is what physiologic hunger feels like. I think we've gotten away from that because we're trained to eat at these times and this type of food, or that's the pattern our family fell into. Like, we have these 7 meals a week, or, you know, and just really evaluating all of that, because that all can fluctuate and change. So those questions, I think, are really important to ask. So I'd say that's my number two that has given me the most ROI, the most return on investment.
Yeah, amazing. I think all good transformations and all results that last come from doing that inner work first and asking yourself these types of questions. And I think probably most people skip that part because they don't even realize that it should be a part of their journey. But yeah, certainly starting there is the way to go. Because like you say, if you can understand what's going on in your body or what's going on in your mind, then you're better equipped to make changes that are going to be meaningful to you and that are actually going to be impactful as well. Thank you so much. This has been so, so interesting. I've loved this conversation. I just know that my listeners are going to love your podcast and everything that you do. So tell us a little bit about that. How can people connect with you?
Yeah, so I have the podcast host of Health Habits and Epic Living. And you can find me there wherever you find podcasts, or you can find me on Instagram at Dr. Sherry Price, or you can come to my webpage, get some free resources and helpful tips at epicyou.com. And that's spelled EPICYOU.com.
Amazing. Well, thank you so, so much again. And we'll speak soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us today. All of Dr. Sherry's information will be in the show notes, and also she'll be tagged on Instagram. I really hope that you've enjoyed this episode. And if you've got any questions, then you can reach me at louise@louisedigbynutrition.com. And make sure that you are registered for my upcoming web class, the 3 steps that I use with my clients to remove weight loss inhibitors and activate weight loss accelerators. You can find out the details of that by visiting louisedigbynutrition.com, or you'll find it in the link in my bio on Instagram as well. And if you're enjoying this podcast, then please do go ahead and hit follow or subscribe, and make sure, please, 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 that you leave a review on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts. It would mean so, so much to me. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time.